Welcome to this Tuesday afternoon, a beautiful afternoon along Michigan Avenue here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. The sun is out for the most part. The temperatures are up, and tax reform is just around the corner. We're singing John Najarian's song. You see John on CNBC and joins us here most Tuesday afternoons. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Great to be back with you. Thank you, Steve.
Happy days are here again. It all comes to fruition today, right?
Well, that's what we're thinking. The bill that has been winding its way through Congress is finally going to be voted on and then hopefully on the president's desk ASAP.
Yeah, it's funny. I give him credit because he kept saying about this big Christmas present, and I didn't think they were going to get it done by Christmas. I thought they were probably going to get something done. I didn't think they were going to do it by Christmas. Are you surprised by how quickly this all came together at the end?
Well, I guess I should say yes.
No, not if you aren't.
Well, I mean, I was hopeful, but I didn't know that they'd get it done because there have been a lot of, you know, starts and stops with repeal of Obamacare and every other measure that they've tried to get through. I think the biggest reason that this one got through is because of the repatriation part of the bill, Stephen. I think that really helps bring it over the finish line, the fact that these companies won't have the excuse to not have that money come back. And I think that's huge.
And we talked a little bit about that last week, that repatriation is coming with few, if any, sort of strings attached. So they might not spend that money on R&D or worker salaries or things like that, but the money is coming back. And as the defendants of the tax bill say, look, it's not going to, the money's not going to sit in a vault. Even if it's a stock buyback, you know, that's going to be money put into the economy in one way or another.
Exactly. And I think that is what's going to happen. We're going to see the money going. Now, it's going to chase goods and services around our economy. So many of us believe that that's going to drive prices higher for many of those goods and services. That's inflation, of course. Many of us have been sort of rooting for some inflation here and there. We'll see exactly how much that inflation impacts us, and I think there's no doubt that it's going to increase GDP as well, and that's the positive side of it. Inflation, we're not as excited about, but definitely the GDP side and acceleration there, I think we'd all be excited about.
John, what's in the bill that you don't like? What part of tax reform do you wish wasn't part of the package?
Oh, I mean, I wish that we wouldn't have a cap of $10,000 on state and local taxes and income tax. For the property taxes, income tax, mortgage deductions, things like that. Now, they do roll off in 2025, but that's 7 years hence, really, once this bill goes into effect in 2018. So those are not permanent, but nonetheless, I think that will impact some spending decisions consumers have. It may impact, as many people have speculated, where people decide to live. Because if you're in a heavily taxed state like the ones I'm in right now, I don't live here, but New Jersey, New York, Connecticut.
Well, Illinois starts California. To come in there. Yeah, I mean, when it looks to property taxes and things, Illinois is like in that next tier, right?
Yep, and property taxes are one of the things that are going to be limited under that $10,000 cap.
So you're the money guy. Can I prepay my property taxes for the next 7 years? Would that be a good move? Do that before the end of the year?
I don't even think you can if you wanted to. But you could definitely prepay what you know you're going to owe in 2018 in that first installment anyway. So you would be wise to do that now, because then you'd still have part of that $10,000 allocation that you could apply somewhere else, perhaps to your income tax, not just to the mortgage deduction and so forth.
You know, it's been a remarkable year, and I want you to look back at it a little bit. It's the last time we'll talk this year. But today, on the day that we look for the package to be approved, the stock markets, all the major indices are in negative territory. I don't think that's much of a big deal. They're not down very much. But, I mean, this tax plan has really been driving the market in the past 6 weeks or so.
Yep, it has. I think in many cases, Wall Street is not as optimistic. Hello, Larry. Just saying hello to Mr. Kudlow.
Put him on. Let's go. We got another phone. We got time for Larry Kudlow.
We always have time for him. He's jumping right into the makeup chair now, though. Oh. But I think overall Wall Street probably isn't, we were just discussing this, whether or not enough of it is priced in, because I think the impact is going to be much more than Wall Street is pricing in right now. They're pricing in relatively modest 0.2% increase to GDP and things like that. And I think it could be more than double that. In other words, 0.5% to 0.75%. So double or triple what most of Wall Street is expecting. That could be a significant driver into 2018 and through 2018.
There's a study out or a survey, manager survey from Bank of America that uses a term I want you to explain for me. It says Bitcoin is the quote unquote most crowded investment in the world. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Sure. There's only 16.7 million Bitcoins that have ever been released or mined, however you want to view it. And yet there are hundreds of thousands of folks who would like to trade it, perhaps millions of people who would like to own it. We all wish we owned it at much lower prices, but it turns out it's the second most searched term on Google this year is Bitcoin. Again, that's with the President of the United States making, you know, news almost every day, if not every day. And so the number one searched item isn't Donald Trump. It is Bitcoin. And it's not North Korea. It's Bitcoin. So I'm not surprised that it's a crowded trade. On the other hand, it is one of a thousand at least viable cryptocurrencies out there. It's just the granddaddy and the biggest. I don't think it'll be the ultimate winner in this, if you want to call it competition. I think it's much like a bunch of small cap stocks. There will be some winners and losers in there. And I think the idea is to try to find the ones that have the most reason to exist. And I think they'll continue to exist and thrive.
All right, John Najarian, what are you watching today? What's got you excited?
I like the Chinese stock a lot. I'll give you two. I like JD, which is just that symbol, JD, and that's an e-commerce site in China. Like that one, upside call buying in there, as well as a semiconductor play, Applied Materials, AMAT. And we bought both for clients today, and AMAT is probably a relatively short-term trade, but JD is well into next year.
Excellent. Listen, John, great to talk to you. Tell Larry Kudlow he's looking good, maybe a little too much on the rouge, but otherwise he's looking like the picture of health. And this is our last time, I think, for the year, so I just want to say Merry Christmas and let you know, just, I mean, honestly, truly, how much I enjoy talking to you and having you be part of this show. So thank you very much.
Well, you're very kind. I love when Bennett rings my phone each week, I'm always glad to see it, and I'm delighted to be on the show with you. So thank you, Stephen. Merry Christmas to all you and all the listeners. A very happy holiday.
We'll talk soon. Kelly Leonard, you know, is the host of the podcast Getting to Yes, and we're going to talk to him in the next half hour. He has talked to Google's chief education guy about getting a quality education for STEM or computer sciences in the classroom, what Google's doing about that, and the need for it. Kelly says that by 2020, the U.S. will have 1.4 million computer science jobs with only 400,000 computer scientists to fill them. So there's that. Also, we'll talk in the next half hour a little bit about a series I've been running. It was just started today, following a couple of great AbbVie scientists who, for the past 5 years or so, have been volunteering their time to come up with a cure for a neglected disease. A little bit later in the show, we'll talk to Katie Owen. She is in charge of the fight against neglected diseases for the Gates Foundation. You know, as many as a billion people around the world are suffering from something that, well, there's just not a huge economic advantage for Big Pharma to come up with a cure from it. So they're working on it, but the, you know, this is a business show. The normal economic drive isn't there. So we'll talk to Katie Owen about what they're doing about that. But right now, where are you going for the holidays? Beth Mosier is on a phone line. She, of course, is the Director of Public Affairs at AAA here in Chicago and in the Northern Illinois. Beth, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I thought you were going to be in studio, but was traffic too bad or what happened?
I was asked to be on the phone.
I'm giving you a hard time.
I'm always happy to come down there and see you all.
I know. So, okay, you know, we always do these studies or we do these stories about this many people flying. I know the mayor's got a news conference this afternoon about the millions he's expecting to go through O'Hare and Midway in all of that. I'm a little bit interested in how 1 year compares to the next and the trajectory. And so numbers are going to be big this year, right? And it shows that they've been getting bigger every year since the recession.
Yeah, absolutely. What we're projecting is that 107 million people are going to travel this holiday week, and it's the largest volume of travelers that we have seen on record. And as you note, it's been increasing since 2008 when we had that recession.
What would be, here's a crazy question. What's the max? I mean, when do we get to the point where everyone who could travel or is going to travel is actually traveling? There must be some, that's a weird question, Beth, I know, but a geographic thing where people are moving further away, so that contributes to it. It's cheaper to travel, so that contributes to it. But I wonder what our ceiling is for people traveling for the Christmas holidays.
Yeah, every year we think that surely we can't outdo next year. There won't be more travelers the next year, and then there is. And this year was a pretty significant increase over last year in terms of the number of people flying, the number of people driving as well. So we don't quite know what the max is, but we measure people that are traveling 50 miles or more, and some people are taking really great vacations.
Yeah, my daughter's actually
part of this.
My daughter just jumped on a plane and went to Florida for a few days because the airfares were so low, and she had a chance to stay at a spot. Long story, but so she just did it, and she's there now. She's coming back tomorrow, and I read from you guys that it makes sense because on paper airfares are down substantially from last year.
Yes, that's what we're seeing, and that's really part of the story here is that airfares are down so much. They're actually at a 5-year low. And so some of our top 10 travel destinations that our travel agency is seeing, Orlando, Anaheim, places in Hawaii, those sound like great places to get away to. So people are really taking advantage of those lower airfares.
And if you're in the hotel business, I'm thinking of a smaller franchise along the interstate or something like that, the rates that you're able to charge your customers is down this year as well. Is that just because of competition, or why is it that hotels are cheaper for travelers?
It is. It's competition. It's capacity. It's all of those things fit into this picture that we're seeing. And yeah, as you mentioned, hotel rates are down a little bit over last year. People are going to make that up though a little bit on car rental rates. Those are the one piece of the puzzle that we're finding is more expensive than this time last year.
Beth Mosher, Director of Public Affairs at AAA. Are you traveling?
Well, I'm going to Northern Michigan to see some family.
Oh, that's traveling. You count.
It is. It is. We like it up there, but it's colder and snowier. So
have a safe time. Enjoy the time with
Thank
your family.
You.
We've been focusing this week in a 720 series on two retired AbbVie scientists who are back in the lab volunteering their time to come up with an effective drug to fight river blindness. It's a so-called neglected tropical disease, or NTD, which affects more than 37 million people, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. They're doing that with the help from the Gates Foundation. Katie Owen is the director of the NTD program for the Gates Foundation, and she joins us now on a phone line. Katie, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks so much, Steve. Great to be here.
Let's start a little bit just in general with NTDs. What are they, and how many people are suffering around the world?
Sure. So NTDs are exactly what the name says, neglected tropical diseases. And the unusual or unexpected thing about it is that despite the fact that they are neglected, that is, very few people actually know about them, they actually affect a lot of people, something around 1.6 billion people around the world in 149 different countries are affected by these diseases. And the diseases largely are parasites, worms, bacteria that cause some pretty debilitating symptoms.
You know, I know they're called neglected diseases, but I've heard others say they're really about neglected people.
I think that's exactly right. These are really diseases of neglected people. For the most part, we don't hear about them in the West because we don't have to deal with them. They're really, it's the people that are in the developing world, people that don't have the financial resources to be able to manage it and that are living in spaces that are not developed, that are really the ones that are at risk and the ones that are dealing with the problem.
So then how can you help us understand the impact of all of this and the value in fighting the diseases?
Yeah, so, you know, the impact comes in multiple ways. You can think about it in terms of the health of the people that are affected, of course. And some of these diseases are quite debilitating. Things like blindness, which of course is bad enough in the U.S., but when you think about it in developing worlds, it really prevents people from having life and livelihood, prevents them from having jobs, prevents them from caring for their families. Also, diseases like lymphatic filariasis that cause things like elephantiasis, so this very vastly swollen limbs, again, prevents people from doing everyday chores, from taking care of their families in everyday ways, or even just taking care of themselves in everyday ways. And again, we're talking about such a large number of people that are affected with some of these problems. The amount of value that comes out of the economies where people are affected is also very significant. And I think if we could get our hands around this a little bit better, we actually have the potential to have pretty significant economic value for these countries as well.
Are these curable diseases by and large, and that they're just not getting the attention because there's not a great economic benefit to drug companies in curing them? Is that what's holding everyone back?
You know, the situation around curing is interesting and different depending on the disease. So back in 2012, there were 10 of these diseases that were highlighted by the drug companies and by groups like the World Health Organization and the Gates Foundation as actually being diseases that we could do something about, that we knew what the cure was going to be, we knew how to prevent them, and it was just a matter of bringing the right people and the right resources to play. And this is actually a story where pharmaceutical companies are really the big heroes in the story, one of the big heroes in the story. And they stepped up and actually are donating huge numbers of medicines, over a billion treatments every single year donated from the pharmaceutical companies to treat all of these people. And then it is a matter of the rest of the global health community, that's ministries of health in country, so in places like sub-Saharan Africa and in India. It's groups like non-governmental organizations that are doing work on the ground in these countries, academic groups that are doing research to understand how best to get the drugs, groups like the World Health Organization and other funders like the U.S. government and the U.K. government that are all coming together to make sure that these donated drugs are leveraged and are actually reaching the people who need them. Because the solutions, we know what the solutions are. It's simply a matter of getting the solutions into the people's mouths.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I think it's easy to blame Big Pharma for not jumping into it. And, you know, here we're doing this story at AbbVie about these couple of scientists who are, well, they're retired. They're coming back and they're volunteering their time in order to fight river blindness.
Yeah, you know, I think you can think a lot of different, the political spectrum of where you would want to go in terms of the pharmaceutical industry is about as broad as there are the number of people in the United States. I do think that neglected tropical diseases is an area where the pharmaceutical industry has truly come in with very real corporate social responsibility and have truly stepped up their game, and in doing so have actually encouraged others to step up and contribute as well. So this is actually a true success story for pharma.
And tell me a little bit about the Gates Foundation and what you're doing to combat all this. I know that you're involved clearly in funding, but give me a little bit about your effort.
Sure. Thanks for asking that question. So the Gates Foundation is a foundation that is built on the mission statement that we believe every person deserves the chance to live a healthy and productive life. And what that means for us is that every one of our actions, every bit of work that we do is targeted towards that particular statement. And so for us, it's a lot about funding. So we do we consider ourselves investors. And what we try to do is choose those investments that we think will have the biggest impact in order to make that statement a reality. So whether that's HIV or TB or malaria, you know, sort of the three big killers in infectious diseases in the world, especially in the developing world where people don't have resources, we do significant investment in those spaces, all the way from research to delivery, or things like the neglected tropical diseases. And so the neglected tropical diseases, which of course is my own personal purview, we fund work all the way from how do we develop these kinds of drugs with pharma companies and with others, including other nonprofit organizations that are doing development. In addition, we fund things like mapping. Where are the diseases? Where do they exist? We help to work with organizations like the World Health Organization to identify what are the technical gaps in trying to make sure that we can actually get these solutions to people on the ground. We work with the World Health Organization in identifying what are the guidelines that are necessary in order to make sure that the drugs are delivered and administered in the right ways. Also with academic partners, so again, how do we think about social mobilization? How do we educate people about what these diseases are? Because no different from you or me, I don't want someone to show up at my door and just hand me a pill and say, please take this pill. You know, the folks that we're serving are exactly the same. So it is about education in the community. It's about reaching those communities and touching those communities where they find themselves. And the Gates Foundation is really fortunate enough to be this nonpartisan player that can, in fact, focus on that mission statement across all of those different partners, and really just to be one of the partners among that mix of all of those partners that I've talked about, to really help try to bring about these changes that we think are absolutely accomplishable.
Well, that's the thing, and I know you wouldn't be in this business if you weren't hopeful, but look into your crystal ball. It seems as if there's been a real turn in the past 10 or 15 years. Where do you see us going? I mean, it looks as if we've made a change, that these fights can be winnable.
I think that's really true. All you have to do is look at diseases like guinea worm, which is, in fact, a neglected tropical disease. And you know, President Carter is a huge proponent of eradication of guinea worm. And, in fact, in 2017 so far, there have only been 26 cases globally across the world of guinea worm. And this was a disease that had impacted hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the past. And I think getting to the eradication of guinea worm is genuinely possible. Getting to the elimination of diseases like lymphatic filariasis, this elephantiasis symptom, and blinding trachoma, those things are possible. Getting to a space where we can control intestinal worms so that maybe they still exist and then they're still transmitted, but they're not causing the kinds of morbidity, the kinds of problems that they've caused in the past, and there is a system in place to actually be able to treat them. You know, we may not get there with all of the diseases, but I'm genuinely hopeful, and with good reason, scientifically optimistic, that we are going to make good progress. And, you know, a lot of that optimism is actually built on the successes we've had to date. So even now, you know, the number of people at risk for neglected tropical diseases in the last 5 years has fallen by 20%. So it's dropped from 2 billion down to 1.6 billion. So 1.6 is still a big number, but boy, we've gotten, you know, going from 2 billion down, that's pretty big. We have eliminated LF from 8 different countries. We've reported the fewest cases of African sleeping sickness than we've ever had in the world, down between 2,000 and 3,000 cases in the world. So there's good reason for optimism. It's not just my Pollyanna.
Nothing wrong with little Pollyanna. Katie Yohan, the director of NTD programs at the Gates Foundation. Katie, it was great to talk to you. I greatly appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Go Cubs.
On this Tuesday afternoon, Kelly Leonard is in the studio from Second City and just about everywhere else, host of the podcast Getting to Yes. And Kelly, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
We haven't really, did we miss a couple turns?
We did.
Okay. Was it my fault?
Yeah, I think it was.
Okay, put it on me. That's fine. Okay. All right. So Getting to Yes And, we've talked about, is an improv term where
yep.
you always are accepting.
Yep.
And you figure out, then you say yes, and then where do we go from there?
Exactly.
How does that fit into your podcast?
So we talk to people who are kind of yes-anding in their business and in their life, and who we talked to this week is Jamie Cassop, who is Google's chief education evangelist.
Is that what they call him? Is that the official title?
Yeah, it is.
Evangelist. Pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
And so I was just saying off the air, Chance the Rapper just did an event with him, and he got I think it was a big donation from Google, too. He was in a school in fifth grade class, and they're teaching coding and things like that.
Yeah, so when I told people I was talking to him, half the people were like, oh, cool, find out this or that about him. Other half were like, why is Google in education? And the fact is, Google is reaching over 30 million kids. They're in all the Chicago public school system. And Jamie taught me a term I had never heard before, which is digital inequity.
Oh, sure. I would imagine I know what that means.
Yeah. So this is the deal is, they've done studies on this, that poor kids, which is kids without Wi-Fi in their home, are entering kindergarten 18 months behind.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
So just think about that. That's where you're starting. You're starting 18 months behind simply because you don't have Wi-Fi in your
home. Okay, so that would imply then that kids with kindergarten are starting 18 months in advance of where we did.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense, because we didn't have it when we were
right,
around.
Exactly.
The access to information is incredible, and it's great. But also, if you don't have it, it pushes you that far behind.
Okay, so when you said half the people say that, I was thinking half the people might say, oh, look, here's Google trying to indoctrinate these young kids. Do you get much of that?
Sure. And when I was doing my research on Jamie, there's a big article in New York Times that was covering this. That sort of presented both sides. They have a lot. They've changed a lot as they've gotten into the space, where they've built safeguards and filters so that, you know, it really prevents people from marketing directly to these kids in very obvious ways. They're really trying to promote equity. And sure, they have a business too, right? So if you're on Google Docs as a kid, chances are you're going to use it when you're in a business as well.
And so what are they doing with these kids? What are they doing in the schools?
They're basically giving them access, and they're giving them tools. And Jamie said a very interesting thing. He said, the question used to be, what do you want to be when you grow up, right? And he says, that is not the question anymore. The question is, what problem do you want to solve?
That's a pretty amazing thing. I read that earlier, and, you know, trying to think of it because, right, fireman, nurse, doctor, what? That's the focus of it.
Yeah, and we're not like that anymore. We've talked about this before, I've worked for Second City for nearly 30 years, the same with you. People don't do that anymore. They don't stay in one job.
Right.
And they're not defined by, I'm a this. He's saying they're going to be defined by, I'm a type of person who wants to promote safety, or I'm a person who believes in supporting people's educational goals, or whatever. And you can do that across a variety of businesses.
Okay, is that in his head, or is he seeing people actually doing that?
He's seeing people do that. Really? That's the way the world is going. People don't stay in their jobs forever. They don't define themselves by a single sort of occupation. And so he's saying that our educational systems have to catch up with that. And they're trying to provide technological tools to help that. There's also, you know, he comes from an immigrant background, no money. And these stats are incredible. Only 13% of STEM degrees are Black or Latino.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. And in Silicon Valley, it's 1 in 14 are Black or Latino. And then this is the big one. By 2020, the U.S. will have 1.4 million computer science jobs, and they're only going to have 400,000 computer scientists.
You know what that tells me, Kelly?
Yep.
It's not too late for us. We should go back to school and get computing skills.
I think that's exactly what we want to do.
Let's review that a little bit. So, because I thought we went through a time where computer programmers were done.
Right.
But are we not talking about traditional
computers? It's
not just
computer programmers, though. I mean, there's so many different kinds of sciences inside computers. So it's not as simple as, like, everyone needs to code, which is, I kind of think what a lot of people think. Like, everyone's got to learn to code. No, they need critical thinkers, because there's certainly going to be people who do quote code, but there's going to be people who have to market this, and there's going to be people who have to think up the next thing that we're going to need. So if you have problem solvers and critical thinkers and original thinkers and creative thinkers, that's the key.
Interesting that as you talk, because we talk a lot about the value of improv, and that it is forcing sort of creativity in the moment, right, on your feet.
Yeah.
And maybe this logic of computer programming is doing just the opposite, but a very valuable sort of skill of problem solving, analytical problem solving by learning code.
Absolutely. That's where these things intersect, because, we're such an analog art form where human beings are trying to work out stuff among themselves. And then you have this sort of digital platform, which is very important for computers to talk to themselves. And when those things come together, that's the sweet spot.
The name of the podcast is Getting to Yes, and it's Tuesday, which means a new one went up, right?
Yeah,
it's up already
today.
WGNradio.com. All right, we'll see you again soon.
Yep.
Have a great Christmas, Kelly.
Happy holiday.